You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
What's up, Connor?
Hey, so in international news, what we're going to talk about is a story from Africa this time. So there's been a campaign currently in that's still ongoing in Uganda to by Ugandan Indians who are a minority in the country to be recognized as a tribe in Uganda. This is not unheard of. This is something that Kenya did a year ago. Kenyan Indians were made the 44th tribe of Kenya. And the idea behind it is to be recognized as, in the eyes of the government and as the indigenous Africans, as being like an intrinsic part of Africa. Now just before I start, obviously I'm going to use, you know, to describe the place of Indians is obviously talking about sociological stuff there. You have to use fairly racialized terms because that's how the society is structured. So I'm going to use white, black, Indian, stuff like that. The other thing I'm going to do is just give you a bit of background before it all starts on when you sit in society. I was talking to my mum about this because my mum grew up in Kenya in the 70s, and I asked her about sort of where Indians sat in society, and they were kind of the middle class. So give you an example. So they would own the businesses in towns a lot of the time. They'd own houses, they'd have cars, they'd be fairly educated, which is a hell of a lot better than a lot of indigenous Africans who'd live in townships in shacks with no running water or electricity. As an example, say if you were going past a railway and you saw a load of African guys working on the railway, building the railway, the former would be an Indian man generally. So that's where they sit. So there's a lot of racial tension, inequality, born out of inequality and sort of racism and discrimination between the two communities. So to see them trying to actively become a part of an African society is a big step. And so, yeah. Anyway, we're going to start off with the piece is going to begin with the most notable person in Ugandan Indian history, Idi Amin. So, yeah, let's get started. Here's Idi Amin.
Uganda will be independent after this, my decision, after I want to see that the whole Kampala street is not full of Indians. It must be proper black and administration in those shops is run by the Ugandans.
Would you like to get all Asians out, really, sir?
Yes, they must go to their country.
Even what? Nationals of Uganda?
If they want to go, they are welcome to go.
What will happen to these people if they don't go by the time they're in?
I think they will be sitting like they are sitting on the fire. I will tell you this. You just wait after 3 months.
What will you do to them?
Okay, you will see.
You said you wanted Uganda.
I think they will not sit comfortable here in Uganda. I will tell you this. I must actually tell you the truth.
46 years ago, in 1972, all 80,000 Ugandans of Indian descent were given 90 days to leave Uganda. 80,000 nationals of a country were made stateless in the space of 3 months, as strongman Idi Amin made it clear that the new post-colonial Uganda was to be a black-only country. Now this year, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi made his first official visit to the East African nation, where he was warmly greeted by President Museveni and the remaining Indian minority. And it's this visit that comes amidst a campaign that would have been unthinkable 46 years ago. Indian Ugandans are demanding to be recognised as an official tribe of Uganda. This is not as far-fetched as it sounds. Just a year ago, their neighbours Kenya made Indian Kenyans the 44th tribe of Kenya, a move that in the mind of the government and black Kenyans made them as African as any other Kenyan citizen. It was meant to not only recognize the contribution Indians made to Kenya, but also to break down the division and hostility that has driven segregation in their society between blacks and Indians for decades. Uganda is trying to do the same. Here are some Ugandan Indians explaining why this status in their homeland has such importance to them.
And this has been my home, Uganda, for ever since my grandfather moved here in 1920, somewhere around there. So that's yes.
Any community goes abroad, they would always like to form or to do, wants to do something for the, that's Indian. Our culture says that if wherever you are, you should work for the betterment of that land. This is what our culture and our ancestors have taught us. We all believe in that.
Many of our Ugandan families send their children out for education and they tell them not to come back. And we do the brain drain. while Indian community brings, calls their children back, either to join the business or their workforce, add on to this, and we are the ones who are stopping the brain drain.
Today, more than 25,000 Indian lives in Uganda, and many of them are from last 20 years have migrated. Few of them have come back from before 1972 era.
Why the tribe? It's nothing to do with land. We don't have. Actually, if this tribe issue is to be considered, we are the most Ugandan tribe, which is spread all over Uganda. Indians were spread all over the place. We have for years been part of the country, Uganda. There was an unfortunate situation which happened in 1972, but we will not cry about that. We'll take it as a lesson learnt, as a history, and we move forward.
You might be wondering then, why on earth there are Indian people in Uganda, of all places? Well, as with so many things in world history, it all comes back to the British and one particular railway. After slavery was abolished in 1833, the British Empire suddenly realised that they had an overnight drop in cheap disposable labour. Realising this, the UK began an indentured servitude system in British India, whereby unemployed Indians would be contractually obliged to work for the Empire overseas in exchange for a wage. This resulted in Indians being shipped all over the world, from Fiji to South America and to parts of Africa. In the case of Uganda, Indian workers were arguably given one of the most grueling, brutal, and murderous projects of the British Empire. The Uganda Railway, also known as the Lunatic Line, considering how expensive and impossible it seemed to build, was built to connect Mombasa on the Indian Ocean to Kampala on Lake Victoria, so that Britain had a reliable transport link across the Great Rift Valley between the two water bodies. Between 1895 and 1903, 35,000 Indians were transported and almost 3,000 died building the railway at a rate of 357 per year, with people being killed by disease, starvation, exhaustion, and random attacks from local native tribes unhappy that a railway was cutting through their ancestral land. Most notably, whilst being forced to work at night, the fate of several Indian workers was immortalised in literature.
It got built up almost entirely because of Patterson's book, Man Eaters of Savo. Those lions caused all their trouble when they were building the railway around about Savo at that time, and those lions did a lot of damage. They killed a lot of people.
At first, rumors of man-eaters were dismissed. The British preferred to explain missing railway workers as deserters. It was the high noon of empire, and when the African natives were unwilling to work for the British, they simply imported thousands of men from India. These workers knew little or nothing about how to protect themselves in the African bush. They were easy prey. Patterson, hired to build a bridge over the Savo River, had no way of knowing he would find himself in a life and death standoff with man-eating lions for nearly a year. Since that time, his story has become an adventure classic. It also inspired a Hollywood film, The Ghost and the Darkness.
The man-eating lions of Savo viciously killed 28 Indian railway workers and almost 200 black Africans. It was a railway built through bloodshed, but it shaped East African society for generations. Many Indians stayed on in Kenya and Uganda, and many more freely emigrated in the years afterwards, when word reached India that fortune could be found in East Africa. The Indians formed a middle class in Ugandan and Kenyan cities. In Uganda, Kampala, Entebbe, Mbarara, Arua, and Kasese all had sizable Indian populations. They owned businesses, lived in houses, drove cars, and were generally more educated and prosperous than the native Africans. This bred resentment with the native Africans, and in Uganda it reached a tipping point in 1972. Idi Amin, officially known as His Excellency President for Life, Field Marshal Al-Haji Dr. Idi Amin Dada, VCDSOMC, Lord of all the beasts of the earth and fishes of the seas and conqueror of the British Empire in Africa in general and Uganda in particular, ordered all Indians out of Uganda in 90 days, leading to mass panic.
Why do you think the president is doing this?
Well, he might be a madman or something like that.
Everybody depends on luck, but they are mostly very, more than they require.
More than terrified?
More than terrified, no.
Are you?
Everybody, not myself. Everybody in this line also.
Can I ask you how you feel at the moment here?
The opening is the same. Everybody is, you know, this. The opening is the same.
Which is what?
A lot of everybody is fearing, you see, the present situation here
in
Uganda.
What are you frightened of particularly?
Particularly, you can't say the situation at the moment, what things may happen in the future.
At the moment, our main worry is to kind of get out of this country safely. We are not even worried about our belongings or our things, but what we would like is personal safety. There have been so many queues and so many forms to be filled up, and life is being made very difficult. There is no outlet. The trains stop the bookings. I mean, do not accept bookings of Asians. There's no seats available in any plane. You cannot go to a neighboring country. So we are, in fact, kind of isolated or kept in this place by force. Although he has given us a deadline, I don't see how we will be able to get out within the deadline.
And what will happen? Is that what you're worried about?
Yes, because a statement has been made that those who stay here after the deadline will be sitting on fire. So we do not know what that sitting on fire really means.
Idi Amin was undeniably unhinged. Among many things, he routinely killed political opponents, seemingly at random, incited tribal violence for his own political gain, claimed he was the uncrowned King of Scotland, married a 19-year-old pole dancer in a £2 million wedding after allegedly kidnapping and beheading her boyfriend, and only fell after he declared war on Tanzania in the midst of one of his paranoid delusions, a war that ended in his exile to Saudi Arabia, where he died in 2003. Today, Uganda is a very different nation. Its economy is still reeling from the effects of Idi Amin and suffers greatly from armed insurgency by virtue of being situated next to the volatile nations of South Sudan and the DRC. But Uganda's Lake Victoria region has consistently made strides to achieve its current status as one of the most stable and peaceful areas in East Africa. And though Uganda still has a reputation of being the poor cousin to Kenya, current President Museveni has not only offered Indians their property back, but has also made it clear that Indians are an intrinsic part of Uganda. Today, 25,000 Indians live in Uganda, and that number is growing. It's fast becoming a place to invest and visit as security improves year by year. The removal of travel warnings from foreign governments, security in national parks on the Congolese border, and new investment being poured into the capital, Kampala, is making it a very appealing emigration option to Indians once again. But tribal status is a rather different matter. It's a decision the nation must make to acknowledge them as Africans like their neighbors to the east did a year ago.
Unfortunately, Kenya is always a step forward than Uganda. I really don't understand. While we conceive ideas, they conceptualize the ideas. Now, this is another thing. Economically also, we have the same problem in Uganda. Socially, we are the same. We conceive ideas. Conceptualization is done by our neighbors faster. And it's a welcoming move, I think. Even if a leaf can be taken from that, especially the Constitutional Court and the Parliament in Uganda, and understand that we are here.
To summarise, on a post-colonial continent where the term African means white, black, or Indian, or otherwise, it will be interesting to see if Uganda decides to follow its neighbours to the east in Kenya and says, yes, we the indigenous of this land say that they are one of us. Because all that the Ugandan Indians are saying, to quote my previous clip there, are three words: we are here.
They are nicking our shit. They totally are.
The Wire. I will give you a quick story. I would have put it into my piece, but I couldn't get a good connection. I was talking to my mum, who's overseas, and she lived in Kenya in the 1970s and was 5 years old when the Indian expulsion from Uganda happened in 1972. And she told me that on the day it happened, she was driving to school as she did every day, sitting in the passenger seat, and my granddad was driving the car, and they got to the Westlands roundabout in Nairobi, and African boys would come out and they'd sell newspapers at the side of the road, and they'd go up to your car window and you'd give them a few shillings and you'd get the newspaper. And she said they came through the guy came to the passenger window, a few shillings, newspaper came in the car, looked on the front page and just saw pictures of Indian people being mutilated and houses burned during this time, and pictures of just trains rammed full of people trying to escape from Uganda and cars coming over the border just loaded with stuff.
Can't really forget a morning like that, eh?
And there was a lot of, she told me there was a lot of paranoia and hysteria in Kenya at the time, because they're wondering, not only will this happen to the Indians, I mean, will the Africans get, you know, the black Africans suddenly decide, you know, we don't want the Indians here anymore and start looting, causing violence, but also there was a sizable white community on top of the Indians in Kenya. So they're wondering, well, if they're going to come for anyone, they're going to come for the white people first. So, because they had the land and they had the wealth and the still had the economic power in the country. Right. So there was a lot of worry about, you know, are we going to be welcome in this country anymore? Are they going to allow us to stay here? I mean, thankfully Kenya didn't go down that path. People realized that Idi Amin was certifiably insane.
Yeah.
But she told me as well that the Indian community were very wealthy, but they kept themselves, and it was kind of like the Africans didn't like the Indians because of their wealth, so the Indians didn't like being resented by the Africans, and it was just this cycle of just discrimination and hatred. And even my mum said her first experience of racism was being bullied by two Indian girls at school for being white. So it was just it's this cyclical thing of racism and discrimination that
right.
builds and builds over generations and gets passed down. And unfortunately, in that case in Uganda, it got heated up. So to see a point in Kenya and
where
potentially
actually,
in Uganda where they're actually accepting these people
yeah.
and saying, you are African, you are one of us, you are a people of this continent.
Yeah, and celebrating that difference.
Celebrating that, yeah.
Cool. Thank you,
it's
Connor.
It's really cool, yeah.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.